Anyway, we'll sort of come to order, and you can do whatever you want until we start.
Well, Mr. Chair, the first thing that I want to do is House File 3236, which when we have a quorum, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this bill, it's pretty short. It simply would have the Commissioner of Health and the Commissioner of Human Services provide a complete physical and actuarial analysis of Representative Bly's bill, House File 135. And I know other states that had similar bills have had fiscal notes done by professional accounting firms, so that's why this bill was submitted. And this is the Minnesota Health Plan bill to get a fiscal note on it. And I don't know if Representative Bly or Dahl want to say anything or just want to watch.
Can senators testify in the House? I guess it's up to me, isn't it? Representative Bly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. As the author of House File 135, I do recognize that we do need to have a financial look at the proposal, and we've been working on this as well with the Wilder Foundation, and I did invite Senator Dahl to come because he's been the primary negotiator with Wilder to talk about that study. And we know that there have been, you know, I also have here a list of studies that have been done in the past on similar kinds of legislation, not this legislation. It doesn't preclude that we shouldn't do our own study, but many of these studies, I think there are 25 or over 25 in this list, all indicate the savings that would occur with this kind of legislation. And it is a major shift in thinking about and looking at how we create access to health care and look at delivery of this kind of system. So if I could have Senator Dahl address some of the concerns and talk about, he also did introduce an amendment to a bill on the Senate side that would ask that certain things that we know savings would occur from be looked at in a study. And if he could comment on the cost of the Wilder study and what that study would encompass.
Senator Dahl, welcome to the committee, and you might decide after this you really want to be a House member in the future. This is the place to be.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll have to consider that. Thank you. It's just the two-year cycle that might be a little bit problematic for me, but I appreciate being here. Thank you for allowing me to come and speak. As Representative Bly talked about, I have been looking at how we could understand a system change that's framed in the Senate file that Senator Marty has and Representative Bly is carrying, and you know, to go beyond the principles and the framework there, but to start to have some experts look at what would be the costs and what would be the benefits of moving in that direction. I think it's important that we have an outside, you know, a research firm take a look at these things if possible. It's the information a lot of times in talking about some of these issues, especially as it's delineated in Representative Bly's legislation, a lot of times gets tied up with anecdotal information and political philosophies, and we want to look at the numbers, and we think it's important to have some degree of separation. So I certainly have been. I've been working with the Wilder Research Foundation to do this. They are very interested in this idea. We've been through Wilder looking at actually national foundations, Commonwealth Fund, Robert Wood Johnson, as well as the ARHCQ. I forget what the acronym is for, but it's for health research and quality. To fund, you know, a comprehensive study, not only give us some information to be able to make decisions on here as we go forward, but also to have use that as well on the national conversation on healthcare, because we know no matter what happens in Washington, we are still going to have to do a lot of the work here in the state. And I think the numbers are what's going to help us to kind of make better decisions. And I think I would highly recommend that if we have a possibility of appropriating funds from the legislature, that we do so.
Thank you. And actually, we can come to order now. welcoming all officially. As Representative Huntley moves that House File 3236 be brought before us. Any questions for Senator Dahl or Representative Bly? Representative Liebling?
We have also people from the department and somebody from the Wilder Foundation is here. Okay. Mr. Chase. He was not able to be here. But we do have people from the department. We have a fiscal note, which they think this study would cost about $250,000. We can certainly, if we can get Robert Wood Johnson to pay for it, that would be a big plus. So is there somebody from the department who would like to just talk about the fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, we have a question from a member first, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if it's so much a question, but I have an amendment, and I just am not sure if, you know, if Representative Bly wanted me to offer that, or maybe it's not time yet to offer it. But
well, we can get that out of the way if it's something agreeable.
Well, it just really is to change the bill a little bit, basically to permit there to be an RFP done instead of having the Department of Human Services actually do the fiscal and actuarial analysis, but to allow them to put out an RFP and have it done that way. So I don't know if maybe
you
want to
pick that up now, or you want to test witnesses first? Do you have a pleasure?
Why don't we hear from the witness first?
Okay, if Representative Lieben can just hold on her amendment. So whoever the first witness is.
I did.
Mr. Greenman, welcome to the committee.
Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I think one thing to keep in mind with regard to this fiscal estimate is we were asked to do sort of an estimate of what we thought something like this might cost. And the department really doesn't have any experience doing this kind of work. We don't typically look at this broad, or the scope involved here is not something we typically do. So we need to confess a little bit of naivete about how much this might cost. And we really only looked at it from the perspective of, you know, what our agency might spend without really knowing what role the other agencies involved are going to play, health, commerce. So I just want to caution people that this is probably definitely an underestimate of what would cost. This is what we're looking at as possibly from the department standpoint. So I just wanted to kind of bring that together. I think the kind of work that would need to go into this would cost significantly more than this. We've spoken to a few people from other agencies that have some experience doing this kind of work, and it does appear that it would cost more. But basically, this was sort of a stab from us, and I think it's good to have people from the Department of Health here as well.
Mr. Green, I have a question for you. In the hearing that we had, I asked a few questions, and some of the parts of the bill are relatively vague, and so you'll have to make some conjectures. And one of the answers was, we'll figure that out when we get there about that. And so are you going to need refinement of the proposal, or can you actually fiscal note some of those things that are kind of just still amorphic in the bill?
Mr. Chair, I think we probably would need to get a few more details about what's expected here. Probably many more details. And the fact there wasn't a lot of detail is one reason why we asked that there not be a fiscal note on this bill, because we just don't know for sure, and we don't want to put down on paper, which we did, what this would cost. I think we do need some more detail.
And how long would it take to do this? Would this be an interim project to do this fiscal noting? Wouldn't be done by the end of session, or would it be done by then?
I'm sorry, sir.
The study to figure out the costs and the bill. If the bill were passed,
to come up with a Mr. Chair, to come up with a fiscal.
Oh, December. Okay, so it's December. Sorry. So it would take you all summer. So, okay, I answered my own question. Are you done? Anybody? Any questions for Mr. Greenman? Okay, Mr. Akam, you want to offer your thoughts?
Mr. Chair, members, Craig Akam with the Department of Health. You know, just to echo what Mr. Green said, there was obviously some confusion here. The fiscal note that we were working on for this was inactivated. and we didn't realize that DHS was moving ahead with some kind of informal estimate. We didn't provide any input into that. You know, one point that the bill makes is that this is a joint responsibility of the Departments of Health and Department of Human Services. You know, we would say that it makes more sense to put this in one agency to provide the administrative oversight and make sure that the project is done. And other agencies, including Health and Commerce, would certainly be able to provide a supportive role to that. But, you know, just from our experience, and we do quite a bit of actuarial analysis in our work, you know, we would say that the actuarial analysis alone, and obviously we haven't talked to any of the other partners or outside organizations that might be interested in doing this, but would probably be much more expensive than this estimate. I mean, it might be in the range of $500,000 just for the actuarial analysis alone. And as you said, Mr. Chair, there's quite a bit of work that needs to go into fleshing out some of the assumptions, some of the processes that would go into actually doing a fiscal analysis of this proposal. And so, you know, I would agree that, you know, our concern would be that if this estimate is being used as an actual fiscal note, that the committee is aware that there are some serious shortcomings, perhaps, in tying the cost of having this done to the committee's satisfaction to this particular number.
I think you've made your point clear. Any questions or comments from the members? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Huntley, I had asked earlier about what the plan was for the budget and the healthcare budget in particular, and I have it now in my hands, and I see that there's, you're looking at $154 million in cuts, presumably, and we're counting on banking an additional $408 from FMAP and another $147 from the GAMC bill. And I'm wondering if you think that this potentially $500,000 bill would be one of your priorities in light of the other numbers.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, that's a very good question, and my intent was to try to find out what approximately this would cost, who would do it, and then it would certainly go, we would be laid over for possible inclusion, but if it's $500,000, maybe we don't have that this year.
Oh, Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I was hoping that would be the answer I would get on that. I would suggest, though, that if you're going to go forward with at some point with a analysis, that you would also look at having them analyze things like patient wait times, private sector jobs, things like that. So it wouldn't just be the financial, but it would also be the overall impact in whole. Just be my suggestion.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, there have been a number of states, at least three that I know of, that have had this sort of analysis done by usually a big accounting or consulting firm. And so I know that they have the results of those, but I don't know if they know what the cost was. And maybe, well, if you could just share some of those. I think Lewin was one.
We'll let Huntley run this. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to address some of the things I heard here, and it's actually, I think it's good news in that the $250,000 is actually, I think, in the ballpark. My work with Wilder, and that's one of the reasons I'm here today, is to represent the work we've been doing with Wilder on this, is they have a target number of $300,000. To do the study, and it would address a lot of the things beyond just, you know, administrative cost savings and things like that, but the broader implications on job loss and things like that. So some of these other implications of changing the system. And they have pledged already at this point $50,000 to do this project, and they're looking for the additional funds from these other organizations. They're looking at about a 12 to 18 month time frame to do the study. The way that it would work is to bring together an advisory board once the money is established that we have enough to move forward, and bring in stakeholders to actually fine-tune what specific questions and variables they would be looking at But it would be based off of the principles that are in the legislation, and then guided from there to decide which ones are most important for us to know in terms of making any future decisions. But the study, they wouldn't do the whole study. If Wilder were to do this, they wouldn't do the whole thing, but they would ship out what they, farm out what they can't do themselves, but they would be the lead research team and the fiscal agent for the project. But they've targeted this as a $300,000 study.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just heard a comment you made, though, that this would take 12 to 18 months. This bill says you'd have to have it done by December 15th of 2010, or is there something in here that I'm not seeing?
Senator Dahl, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, perhaps I was in too much of a rush. So, I mean, that date, it sounds like that date would not work, or that timeline would not work. So it has to be longer.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Ms. Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know, too, that costs usually go up. When the time frame is shorter, you have to put more resources at it, and the risks go up, too. So I think that also affects the fiscal implications as well.
And just a comment to the... I'm not sure what your position on the bill is, but I know the two advocates here. If you listen to what the department suggests, I didn't vote for your project, but if you want to get a real analysis, you may have to fill in, work on some more in-depth language to let them actually analyze it. There's many parts of the bill that are extremely unclear, and it takes more time to analyze unclear, and the assumptions might come back like not the ones you had in mind. So mm-hmm. I believe the bill is sitting in this committee. Is it, Representative Huntley?
Yes.
And so, I mean, just keep that in mind as you try to get something done. So it would be nice to know what it really did cost. That would be kind of interesting. Representative Bly.
Yes, I think we're aware of your concerns and would hope, I think, in working on the study, be able to flesh out some of those things as well. And I intended, as I think I indicated in the policy committee, that I would like to work in the interim to answer some of those questions as well. I just wanted to also indicate that I do have this list of national and state studies that were done on this type of legislation, which I can make available to the committee, and I offered that to Representative Huntley as well.
Okay. Is there more witnesses? Representative Huntley? Representative Liebling, do you want to do your amendment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is, I believe, in members' packets. And this is the A1 amendment.
Representative Liebling moves the A1 amendment. Do you want to describe it?
Yeah, all that this does, Mr. Chair, is instead of having the department provide the fiscal and actuarial analysis, it has them offering a request for proposal and getting bids from the actual written amendment says a nonprofit organization, but I would want to say from nonprofit organizations, plural, located in Minnesota. So it basically says instead of doing it themselves, that they would ask for bids from organizations that could possibly do this. So that would be, so let me, so on the A1 amendment, I would incorporate the following change. On line 3, I would strike the first, the letter A. So it would say bids from nonprofit organizations, put an S at the end of organization. So I would incorporate that change into the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Oh. And I believe also nonprofit doesn't have a hyphen in it. So, so that's what staff tells me. So, okay. So Representative Liebling moves to amend on line 3 to strike the A and add an S after organizations, and she'll incorporate that into her amendment. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, why would you restrict it to nonprofit organizations, and why just Minnesota? I mean, Deloitte Touche was a company that does these things. They do have an office in Minneapolis, but I don't know if you would consider them a Minnesota company or not.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not wedded to this. I mean, I guess I would ask the Representative Bleier, Representative or Senator Dahl, if they have strong feelings about this. I don't.
I can answer.
Senator Dahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I personally, if you're going to open it up, I mean, I don't think it has to be, you know, a wilder study if that's what you're trying to design the language for. I think anybody that would be willing to provide a bid, if we can get a lower price bid or a better quality product, I would be in favor of it.
Other comments?
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So I guess we need to modify it even a little bit more here. I guess then we would take out, we would strike the words nonprofit and strike the words located in Minnesota. So it would now be jointly offer a request for proposal and accept bids from organizations.
You don't even need organizations anymore,
yeah.
Probably. You just accept bids.
So less and less here. Okay, let's see. Here we go. Sorry about this, members. Okay. Jointly offer a request for proposal and accept bids for the completion of, is what that line would now say.
So Representative Liebling moves to delete everything between from and Minnesota inclusive. And she'll incorporate that into her amendment. Any questions about the amendment as amended? Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think I understand what you're doing here, but I'd like to hear it in your own words. What assurance do we have that these organizations are qualified or are going to give us the kind of analysis we need on something as massive as an analysis of completely converting our healthcare system in Minnesota to government-run?
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative Gottwald. You know, that's what a request for proposal is. The departments would put together the criteria that would have to be met. That's what this process is. So they would be determining what kinds of qualifications they would need from the companies who would be bidding on this. That's what you do when you put out an RFP.
Yeah, I'm familiar with RFPs. But thank you.
Any more conversation? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, why the Healthcare Access Fund, which is about to go bankrupt?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, I had that in there because I understood that was your intention. But if it isn't, if it was your intention that it be general fund, that's fine with me, too. I'm not really the author of this language, so...
Representative Huntley.
Well, I prefer not at this time to look at the Healthcare Access Fund.
Well, I have no problem.
Liebling.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I have no problem striking that language.
So do you want to incorporate deleting lines 4 and 5 then?
Sure.
Representative Liebling incorporates that. We're down to parts of lines 2 and 3. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just be curious if someone from the Department of Health or Human Services could maybe comment on Representative Gottwald's question if they felt that there would be organizations out there that would have the wealth of knowledge that they have.
I think Mr. Akim's going to come back. So, and probably a couple more minutes on this, and then we'd probably discuss this topic pretty thoroughly unless there's a real will to do more. Representative Mr. Akim, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, I'm sorry I missed Representative Gottwald's question. I'm wondering if someone could repeat it, please.
Representative Pepin or Gottwald, whoever wanted to ask the question.
Mr. Chair, I think I'll take that. But the question that I was asking is, we're limiting this to organizations in Minnesota. That much I understand from the amendment.
No. Yeah, the amendment now that we have, just to help members clarify, we have all of line 2 left, and we have on lines 3 we have bids for the completion of.
Mr. Chair, I still have concerns. We're not specifying anywhere in this bill or in this amendment what kind of organizations we're looking for. And I understand RFPs could specify that, but there's nothing in the bill that says any of that. You know, what we want in an RFP, for example, would be kind of nice.
Do you have an amendment, Representative Gottwald? Okay. Representative, anybody else want to? Representative Huntley.
Well, I mean, we're asking in the bill for the Commissioner of Health and Commissioner of Human Services to do this and to put requests out for bids, and they do this routinely, particularly for large studies like this. They are not usually done in-house. And so I guess I would have faith in the two commissioners to decide who was suitable. And I guess my guess would be, if it was not Wilder who put together a group, that it would probably be one of the big accounting firms.
Okay, Representative Pepin, and then we're going to vote pretty soon.
Thank you. Yeah, I just was wondering if you felt that there were outside organizations that would have the depth of knowledge that you have to do everything we're asking to do, since this would be such a major change, probably the biggest change we'd ever had in the state as far as the direction of our health care policy. And I'm just wondering if you felt that the best direction for that would be putting that out in RFP, and if there were organizations that you felt could do what you do.
Mr. Aiken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services routinely rely on outside partners and organizations for pieces of a number of different projects or analysis that we do. Currently, for example, we're working on the health reform activities that were passed in 2008, and we're utilizing a wide variety of partners with different expertise. Whether there is a single entity outside that probably has all the expertise to do all the pieces required for this fiscal and actuarial analysis, I can't say. I could also say that the Department of Health nor the Department of Human Services probably has all the expertise to do that either. And so it'd be some blend. The one thing I would say about the amendment as changed, though, in terms of providing a joint RFP, that provides some difficulties in terms of our administrative capacity. Generally, RFPs are submitted and administered by a single agency, and for two agencies to have joint responsibility for that presents some challenges.
Mr. Chair,
Huntley.
I would move on line 1.6 to strike and...
Actually, we have to work on our First Amendment first. We can come back to that we deal with this. So we'll take that up the next thing. So I think that's probably going to be friendly. Any other discussion about the amendment? Representative Pepin, did you still have more questions?
No, I don't really have a question, Mr. Chair. I just was thinking, I think the reason Representative Huntley wanted to do that is because I think perhaps Representative Liebling would like Representative Huntley's direction in changing her own amendment, perhaps, about the health, about the RFP going out to two, through both of them.
So okay, that's cool. Use your telepathy through the chair, please, if you will. Representative Liebling, did you have a thought?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would say, just for simplicity, maybe we should just vote on this, and then Representative Huntley can offer further.
Okay.
Can offer further
amendment. Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed. It's adopted. Representative Huntley,
the amendment. In line 1.6, I would move that we strike Commissioner of Health and.
Representative Huntley moves on line 1.6. We strike Commissioner of Health and the. Is everybody clear about that? Staff got that?
No.
Okay, we're striking the Commissioner of Health and the. Representative Pepin to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, did Representative Huntley also want to remove the word jointly?
Oh, jointly.
From the amendment, the adopted amendment? On line 2?
Well, we'll have to amend. You want to? I think, well, that'll be another amendment, so we'll get. Could we do that? That's too complicated for staff. So I think we could also remove jointly from the A1 amendment. That's probably appropriate. So Representative Huntley incorporates that into his amendment to remove jointly on line 2 and to strike Commissioner of Health and the from line 1.6. Any questions about that?
Yeah. Oh, that was in your amendment. Yeah. Okay.
So you've already incorporated that into your amendment, Representative Huntley. So,
okay.
All in favor of this clarifying amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? See, we're agreeing on stuff here.
Mr. Chair, then I would like to move that House File 3236 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
So done. Actually, was any more testimony about this? I think we're done. Representative Bly, do you want to last?
Just one comment.
Put while your head, you know.
Go ahead. Senator Dahl did have an amendment to a bill in the Senate that did lay out a number of the things that we would be looking for in the study, and we can certainly provide that to Representative Huntley as he considers this.
He'd like that. The bill's laid over. So we'll take up 3236 now. Rep. Something moves.
37.
3237 be held over for possible inclusion. Is this going out? Right. Where is it going, Rep. Senator Huntley? K-12? And be recommended to pass and be sent off to K-12, actually be to finance, sorry. To finance to be going to K-12. Is that right?
The Finance Committee.
Right.
Yes. And I have a couple of amendments that sort of get it in the order that I want it.
I don't have those.
And this is the Department of Human Services policy bill. Most of you have heard it discussed in the policy committee. The big bulk of it is just adapting to changes in federal law and clearing up language in the in our laws. And I would move the A5 amendment.
Rep. Huntley moves the A5 amendment. Do you want to describe it for us?
Well, that's just it's just clarifying language about health plans.
Any questions about that, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment's adopted. You have the A6, too? Or is that another one?
And then you have this one?
Just an oral amendment.
Yeah, and then I have an oral amendment Article 16. It would say this article is effective on July 1, 2010.
So what page is that on?
31. 36.
Page 36.
36.
And so on line 36.4, you're gonna have this article's effective July 1, 2010?
Right.
Is that correct? Do you have that? Okay. I can do that. So just to repeat, on line 36.4, we're going to insert this article is effective July 1st, 2010. Any questions about that? Is that anything we should know about what difference that makes?
It was just left out by oversight.
All right. Any questions about that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Moving along, Rep. Huntley. Is there the A6 too? Is that from you, or is it? And I do have an oral amendment of my own. It was in the drafting, Rep. Huntley. The amendment that we put on in policy didn't get carried through from the revisor about that household of one. That was amended in policy. And so I'd like to move that myself on page 6, line 28. I've got it written down for you. After less, insert for a household size of one. And we discussed that pretty thoroughly in policy. Do any people on page 6, line 28, that 350% of poverty was for one person, not for whatever size household. So is everybody clear about that? On line page 6, line 28, after less, insert for a household size of one. So that brings it up to about, I think, $18,000 for one person.
Any questions about that? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
That's adopted.
There you go. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A1 amendment, and this is mine, not the department's.
That's A6. And, it's A6, maybe? Is that the?
Oh, yeah, there it is. A6.
Okay.
I have two copies. This relates to the private duty nursing services that we discussed in some of our committee hearings. And right now, if someone is covered by insurance and they need private duty nursing, and, but they're eligible for medical assistance, right now they're put into, a lot of them are put into the medical assistance so that we pay for them rather than their insurance company. And this would require then the insurance company to provide those services. Most of the insurance companies, but not all, already provide this.
Okay. Questions, Representative Pepin?
And Mr. Chair, was it $19 million? The estimate for the savings to the state are $19 million.
That could pay for your study then, maybe, huh? Representative Pepin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. That was one of my questions, how much it costs. How many, could you remind us again, how many mandates do we have as a state? Mr. Chair, I was just curious.
Around 50.
Representative Huntley.
Around 50.
Around 50?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Pepin.
I thought it was pushing 70, but I guess you're the chair. I'll take your word for it. And what is the relation of the amount of mandates that we have in comparison to other states? And the reason I'm asking is because that obviously has a direct cost on the cost of health care, which we have to be very concerned of with our budget situation the way it is. And then also, I guess my follow-up would be, does the department support this? You said it was yours, but does the department support this?
Representative Huntley, do you want to respond? Or?
Yeah. Oh, well, let me respond. You are correct that the mandates cost money, but if you look at simply the mandate for pregnancy coverage and the mandate for mental health, that's about 75% of the cost of mandates, just those two. So all the other ones, while they cost money, are not that expensive.
Ms. Kojicevic, do you want to comment, or is this...
Mr. Chair members, this actually has been worked, another area within our agency has been working on this, so I may ask if they would like to speak to it.
Yeah, I think that we need an official word for the request, if they would come down. And then if anybody else wants to testify about this, this would be a good time to bring it up after that. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for coming down. So please state your name for the record, and then did you hear the question?
I would like the question repeated. My name is Pam Urkel. I'm with the Department of Human Services.
Representative Pepin, do you want to restate your question?
Yeah, my question, I guess, was part of it Representative Huntley answered. I'm wondering how many mandates we have compared to other states. If you could kind of say, is Minnesota in the top 5, 20? Maybe you could touch on that. And then the other thing was just, do you support this? This is, looks like it was supposed to be an agency bill, and just wondering if you support this amendment.
Chair, Representative
Ms. Urkel.
We worked with the House research staff to put language together for this bill, but we do not have a position on the bill. And in answer to your first question, I am not in the area that would know whether or not although I was here last night, and last night I did hear there were like 54 mandates, and so that's what I heard last night.
Representative Pepin. Okay. And, well, I think that answers the question that people, does anybody else want to testify about this? Mr. McLaren, do you want to come? I think you can probably go if you like. Thanks for coming down. Oh, is there another question? I'm sorry, Representative Bonney has a question. I'm sorry, she's behind staff there. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask the agency to explain private duty nursing. My understanding is that it's for individuals that if they weren't being cared for in the home in this manner with private duty nurses, that they otherwise would qualify for hospitalization. First of all, I want you to clarify if that's a correct statement, if not, what private duty nursing is. And secondly, if you or if the health plans in the room know whether if the person was hospitalized under their health insurance, would they then be covered as opposed to if they are paying for the private duty nursing? So these plans that might not be covering private duty nursing, would they be required under those same plans to pay for the hospitalization if that choice was made rather than this? And my understanding is that this is a cheaper option than hospitalization typically, so I would think it would benefit the plans to cover this if, in fact, otherwise they would have to cover hospitalization. So I just want clarification from you and or the plans to those issues. Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Urkel, did you get all that? Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, private duty nursing services are state plan optional services that Minnesota provides through our Medicaid state plan. They're provided in a similar manner as PCA. In other words, we authorize based on assessed need. We authorize an amount of time. Usually it's in hours. It's not very short periods of time. The people who receive these services are chronically ill. They have chronic conditions that require them to be on, for example, ventilators, or they have some very multiple different disabilities that require them to have private duty nursing, degenerative diseases, etc. And so we do have the program. There's about 500 people on that. And for one of our waivers, the community alternative care waiver, a person would require a hospital level of care in order to be on that waiver. For persons who are generally on medical assistance and require private duty nursing, it does talk about in our statute that they would require a level of care, for example, in an intensive care unit. We have different levels, complex private duty nursing and regular private duty nursing. And most of these people would otherwise have, if not be consistently in a hospital, would be in the hospital very, very often.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you for that answer, but I guess what I'm having a hard time getting a handle on is that, which is that the core of the amendment is this issue that there might be families who give birth to a child that has severe technological support needs for an extended period of time, if not life. They had private insurance at the time. This is where I think the bill comes into play. So I want our members to understand it. And of course, that child then would qualify for MA type TEFRA things because of their disability status, but the family's private insurance might not cover private duty nursing. My question was trying to get at if the private insurance would have covered or does cover hospitalization under their insurance coverage, how is it that there's this loophole or this that they can do this, that this portion of it, whereas the hospitalization might not have been pushed onto MA on the state, how is it that this service, given its equivalent to kind of hospitalization, is able to be diverted to the state? I guess that's what we're trying to get at with this amendment, I think, and whether what's appropriate here. I don't think it's like every other mandate necessarily. I think it's a more complicated issue than that, and I'm trying to understand it. So if you could help us with that.
Representative Bunn, the plans are going to come down and testify too, so maybe you can, between the two, three witnesses, we can get that answer. But go ahead and identify yourself.
My name is Jan Taylor, and I'm with the Department of Human Services in the third-party liability area. And actually, in terms of, I believe you have a copy of some information that I had gathered from claims that I reviewed and decisions that were made by private insurers for private duty nursing services. And there were a variety of different denials. I'm sorry, I think this was maybe the other day that you had this information. No,
they don't have
okay. They don't have sorry. So the reasons for denial of payment do vary considerably. And so I did do kind of a report that showed, non-covered services, which is is pretty generic. One would hope that we could become, could get to a more specific denial if, in fact, you know, it was a covered service, but it just didn't meet some other criteria. You also have situations where they, the benefits under the plan have been maximized. They've used the maximum either in terms of their lifetime benefit or their annual benefit, and deductibles not met. And so there's a variety of reasons that something might be denied. And I guess I would defer to the health plans in terms of, you know, that direct correlation between inpatient hospitalization and private duty nursing out, you know, in a home-based situation. But I know in the past, you know, there have been issues of medical necessity and so forth. And so one of the things that we looked at was trying to correlate to the actual definitions that we use for coverage in the medical assistance program, Medicaid coverage of private duty nursing services, which is what Pam, you know, went through as far as the categories.
Well, let's maybe hear from the plans. You kind of pull up a chair there. And I think you can stay. Or if you want to move, you can. Whatever you prefer. Okay. Maybe you're done. I wouldn't go too far away just yet, though. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica. And I have to admit, I didn't prepare testimony for today, so there are just a number of issues that I wanted to address with this, and I want to also say that I believe I'm testifying also on the behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We are opposed to this provision in the bill, and we have testified in other committees about this, but I wanted to touch on several or three different kind of macro financial issues for to throw into the discussion today. First, when Representative Huntley was talking about how this bill saves $19 million, I may be presuming, to the state, what we have to remember is if that's the savings to the state, then it's more than a 50%. You have to add another 19 and more because of the enhanced FMAP, of the impact that it would have possibly to the private industry. Second of all, you have to be looking also at the number of people that this would affect who have both the private insurance and the MA. As you've heard in different committees, these mandates apply to about 27% of the health insurance or the 27% of Minnesotans. So if we're spending the state is spending $19 million on private duty nursing, they may not be able to save all that because of how far the mandate would reach. So that's the second issue I wanted to throw out there. The third issue would have to be if this mandate applies to CGIP, the state employees or the state would also have to pay for part of this mandate as well. And we'd see how all that shakes out in the fiscal note. But I just wanted to raise those three kind of macro level financial issues.
Mr. McLaren, if so, would this cost the plans $38 million then? Is that how much, if it's 19 to us, would it, by your math, doubling it? Is that the impact on if all that could be shifted to plans? But it couldn't be, but if it theoretically could go to everybody.
Mr. Chairman, I want to point out you'd have to have that, see how it would interact with the 27% of the market that would be impacted by this, but I was just wanted to kind of illustrate how whatever would be saved by this
would be doubled to you
or more because of the enhanced FMAP that we're receiving right now.
And what if the Minnesota said we're just not going to pay for this at all, then would you have to pick up that? Without making a mandate, we just say we refuse to pay for this service. Is that something you would pay then because nobody else was going to pay it?
That's a good question, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if I can answer that directly, but I will answer when I know that I understand Medica covers, and we do cover 8 hours a day of private duty nursing called in-home care. So we do cover these services now.
And how does medical assistance become the primary?
I think that gets beyond my realm of expertise, but it's my understanding that this may apply to the children or people who qualify under TEFRA, who have both private insurance and Medicaid. But if I'm incorrect, I'd let the department.
I don't know how far I went. I just was a question. So
that's my understanding.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer, did you have a question?
No, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking forward to asking some questions on the rest of the bill, and I would just kind of keep an eye on the clock and just kind of checking to be sure we might be able to get to other questions on the bill also.
We're going to. Yeah, we have, but it's a good question. So anyway, any more discussion about this amendment? I remember the bill's being laid over for...
No.
Okay. Oh, it's one of the... Oh, it's leaving, sorry. So yeah, this is our last chance. Representative Bunn, and then we're going to vote.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I liked your question, and I like the department to answer the question. People often talk about the fact that Minnesota provides a number of the non-federally qualified optional services, and this is one of those. And I'd like the department to answer the question, if this was zeroed out, what does that mean for our state budget? In terms of where it would be picked up. My guess is that the cost has shifted elsewhere and probably more expensively, but I want to hear that stated so that people know when we talk about zeroing out some of these optional things, it often just shifts the cost and sometimes higher cost elsewhere. But I don't want to lead the discussion. I want to hear you say it.
Thanks. And just to remind members, we do have two more bills. I don't want to come back tonight unless you all do. And this is a discussion that could take the balance of the time. It's kind of interesting to me, but I think if you kind of give us a short answer, Ms. Urkel, and then if you want to go to the hallway and discuss some more with Representative Bond or at a future time, that would probably be quite a good idea. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Bond, if Minnesota didn't provide private duty nursing services, the majority of the people that are currently receiving private duty nursing services would end up in... most likely living in hospitals or perhaps nursing facilities, depending on their level of care. If they live in a nursing facility and they're on medical assistance, then we would pay for that nursing facility. If they're in a hospital and they have health insurance, to the extent that their health insurance would cover that, it would cover that to their maximum, and then they would go on to medical assistance and we would pay the hospitalization at that point.
So I think that pretty, you get the last question, Representative Kiffmeyer, then we're going to vote on the amendment, and then we'll move to the bill.
Right, as I listen, sometimes we go in circles, and it's been an interesting thing. I think, for me, the most important thing is, does this amendment put us in a situation that it costs more money or not? I mean, in the beginning it was looking one way, and now I'm not sure anymore where we're really at on the funding here.
Representative Huntley.
Now, what will happen if this passes and becomes law is that these people that are eligible for medical assistance but have health insurance usually through their family, then the health insurance would have to cover the cost of the nursing, and the state would not pay the medical assistance for those people for that particular service.
And that would be in the fiscal note that would back this bill to K-12 finance. I think we've discussed this pretty well. Anybody have a pressing need to ask another question? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. The amendment is adopted. And is that all the amendments you have?
That's it.
Okay, to the bill. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley. I have a few questions. I got my fingers in here. And
I'm going to get the...
Oh, he's going to phone a friend. Ms. Kojisoy, welcome back. Actually, we need to, when you say your things, say your name for the committee, because we didn't get that part done first. So, but wait till a question comes. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just some clarifications here. In line 11.14, I'm seeing some stricken language, and this has to do with just to allow you to get time. You get there, it's on page 11, line 12. And... the first stricken language is fine. It's not an issue. I would just have a question about, it says, to a woman who is eligible for and receiving medical assistance on the date of the child's birth shall continue to be eligible for medical assistance without redetermination until the child's first birthday, as long as the child remains in the woman's household. And that's been stricken. There must be something behind that.
Ms. Kojisoy.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Shannon Kojisoy. I'm the legislative liaison at the Department of Human Services, Healthcare Administration. And this is just updating this language in adherence to federal requirements. And so due to that, it is no longer required that the child remains in the home to receive this assistance. And so that is why that language has been stricken.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that does clarify it. Thank you very much. The other one that is, again, just some clarification I saw here was on page 17, line 17, 8, and 9. And the concern I have here, and again, this may be another explanation, is that before this was medical assistance covers dental services for children that are medically necessary. Now we've added pregnant women, and certainly this is not about any pregnant women who need dental services. My question is just if we're expanding something and it's going to be, you know, a circumstance here, I just think we need to know what these things cost us, or if we are expanding, maybe there's another story.
Sure. Ms. Colgesoy.
Mr. Chair, members, this was, again, just clarification language to actually get the language saying what was said last year when it was fiscal noted. So this is just updating the language to a previous fiscal note and has no impact or no change of current practice.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then on the same page, line 14, it appears as though we're having a new entity thing, being orthodontia, is eligible for coverage for children only. Maybe this was also something like that, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, members, again, yes, it's clarifying that the orthodontia is only available for children. There was some concern that it might be misconstrued to also be available to pregnant women. And so this is clarifying, again, that it is not available to anyone other than children. Again, in adherence to the fiscal note.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And my last area for now is on page 32, and it's actually, there's a few sections here, and it has a new language. It says at the top of the page 32.1, and then repeated a couple other places, that the income standard shall not go below those in effect on July 1st, 2009. And that's a retroactive kind of a situation, and so that maybe there's also background to this as well.
Ms. Kojicek.
Mr. Chair, members, this is just some language to allow the department to continue to use the federal poverty guidelines that are currently in statute in case they are changed by federal law. And so this is just some comfort language to allow that for us to continue to use what is currently being used. And again, should have no fiscal impact.
Okay. Any more questions to the bill? Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against the bill? No big lineup, President Huntley. So do you have any last thoughts about this bill before you head out to finance?
No, I would renew my motion. This be approved and sent to the Finance Committee.
She'll get it. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. You're out of here.
Okay, next we have Representative Murphy with House File 3266.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to move that House File 3266 be considered and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And, Mr. Chair, I have the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the order that I'd like, so I'd like to move the DE1 amendment, please.
Representative Murphy moves the DE1 amendment, which is the delete all. And that would get the bill away if he now wants it. So any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? So the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This is a bill that modifies the MA pharmacy reimbursement formula to offset any reduction in payment resulting from the settlement of a recent federal lawsuit. The settlement in part lowered the base average wholesale price amount that DHS uses to calculate the MA payment rate, and this has the effect of reducing the reimbursement that pharmacies would receive from the Department of Human Services. This is an issue that I've been working with the pharmacists on now for a few years. In 2007, we tried to preempt this change by changing the dispensing rate for pharmacists, and we were unsuccessful. And so we're back today with this piece of legislation. After the result of the lawsuit to try and keep pharmacists across Minnesota whole in the work that they're doing, and I have a couple of testifiers that would like to share their information with you. Thank you.
Would you state your name for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Johnson. I'm a pharmacist and currently the executive director for the Minnesota Pharmacists Association. Here speaking, obviously, in support of House File 3266. Pharmacy colleagues from all practice settings have been working, as Representative Murphy has said, with us to address this reimbursement issue, and I'd like to provide a little bit of background, if I could, about the issue. It's a little complicated how pharmacists are reimbursed for dispensing, so I appreciate the time to remind you. I know you've heard me before, but the purpose of this bill, as Representative Murphy stated, is to adjust Medicaid reimbursement to where it was before September 29, 2009. This date marked the beginning of a disastrous cut to pharmacy reimbursement and a real threat to continued access for Medicaid patients in our state. As many of you already know, Medicaid and virtually all commercial plans use AWP, or average wholesale price, as a benchmark, or list price if you want to compare it to cars. For pharmacy reimbursement, and have for many years. In 2006, this benchmark was called into question and subsequently recognized it as an unsound tool to calculate reimbursement. While virtually all other payers in the marketplace recognized the need to adjust immediately so that pharmacy was kept whole, they did so. Minnesota Medicaid was not able and could not be persuaded to make any adjustments, and thus this put the state in a position to capitalize on this opportunity, this fluke, if you will, in the change of list price to realize a windfall for the state's ailing budget, and that's been happening since September 29th of 2009. Again, nothing has changed. Pharmacies do not buy better. They do not get to mark it up anymore. What changed is the list price. We ask that the legislature act to adjust these rates and keep pharmacists and pharmacies in Minnesota able to serve their patients. Add a little bit more of history. Over the last several years, reimbursement rates have been decreased numerous times by the legislature. A lot of us have sat before you to try to explain the detrimental impact that we believe continual erosion of pharmacy reimbursement would have on our ability to continue to serve patients. We have provided information on the number of pharmacies in Minnesota that pharmacies Minnesota loses each year, especially in the rural areas, because of economic challenges they face. We respectfully have accepted, not liked, but accepted the half or 1 or 1.5% decreases that have resulted from intentional cost savings proposed by the state each year. But this 5% unintended decrease that the state intentionally decided not to correct, that has been swept into the state budget since September 29th of 2009, is a harder pill to swallow. I must remind you, when I say 0.5% or 1% or 1.5% or even 5%, that percentage is a percentage off the average price of a brand name prescription, which is a very large number. That's $200 to $300. So we're not talking, pharmacists taking home 1% less, which doesn't sound like much. If it were that, I probably wouldn't be here. Since 9/29 of 09, Medicaid has listed this decrease in reimbursement as savings. These savings represent dollars lost by pharmacies as the dispensing of certain brand name drugs is done so below cost. Contrary to popular belief, many pharmacies have chosen to leave the Medicaid program. But they have done so not by choice. They have done so by closing their doors. Those statistics are lost, but not to many rural counties in our state that no longer have access to a pharmacist or a pharmacy except by mail. This loss is detrimental to their communities as patients lose vital access to appropriate health care. I took the liberty of putting up some rough numbers together provided by the Board of Pharmacy on numbers. And this isn't to pick apart the numbers to say, well, that number's one or two wrong. This is to demonstrate the economic strain in our state to pharmacies. I know we're all there and the state is there, and you folks know it better than anybody. But just to cite a few numbers, in 2009, 76 pharmacies closed in Minnesota. 25 of them were rural. In 2008, 23 pharmacies closed in Minnesota. 10 of those were rural. 07 was 25, 8 were rural, and on and on and on. What's important here is the trend. What's important here is the demonstration of the economic challenges that are faced by pharmacies right now. These do not include 4 pharmacies that my colleague is going to talk about that closed in the last few months of 2010. Where was I? We ask that you support House File 3266 in order to reestablish reimbursement rates to maintain pharmacies whole and keep their doors open. I want to be very clear about what we're asking for here. We're not asking for an increase in what the state pays us. We're asking that state do the right thing and maintain reimbursement as it was prior to the benchmark changes that incurred industry-wide. It's a critical time as the financial future of many pharmacies are depending on a system that has failed to answer their needs appropriately to the detriment of those who the pharmacists and the state of Minnesota both serve. I want to add a couple more things, and we provided a piece of paper that is ultimately what we don't want to happen, and that is that for pharmacies to leave the Medicaid program by choice. This is happening right now in the state of Washington. To what extent, I don't know. I'm only providing the facts here, so I don't think that's a trend we want. That's why we fight so hard to ensure that we can maintain access. These are real threats to our state. Minnesota Medicaid, just as a note, the Minnesota Medicaid rates for Minnesota are worse than they are in Washington. I would just keep that in mind when we decide what decisions to make. And I have one more comment, and I'll stay for questions, of course. And that is, we've done a lot of things here with your help over the last several years, many of you in the room, you included, increasing the abilities for pharmacists to contribute to the healthcare system by providing immunizations, by MTM, the medication therapy management that we all love. Every time we bring one, it passes with flying colors. And that's a pharmacist's ability to contribute to the system in ways that save the system money. Well, my fear, and I can tell you right now, we are at a point where if we do not adjust these rates, we're not going to be around to do the fun stuff. We're not going to be around to do vaccinations or MTM. So it's very serious, and I very much appreciate you listening to me. Thank you.
Representative Gottwald had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, this cause is something I've talked about quite a bit, the cost shifting that goes on because we underpay providers on medical assistance, general assistance, medical care. Obviously, the question comes up, where are we going to find the money to do this time around? But it is a cost shift. It's not only damaging access, but the costs that we don't pay on public programs get paid. They get paid by everybody else, and that impacts their access to health care. We have some ideas still here at the legislature that might pay providers commercial rates on public programs, and we ought to be exploring those ideas as well as looking for new sources of revenue from the federal government or other places, Representative Huntley. But I guess I'm kind of amplifying the message here, but I want to thank Representative Murphy for bringing this forward. I realize that's not easy to do in a year when we're saying we can't spend any more money. But there are collateral impacts here, and just because we're not spending it here doesn't mean it's not getting spent by somebody else somewhere else. And so I'd be glad to contribute some good ideas to maybe getting some more of that revenue to them.
Well, Representative Gottwald, you may be interested to know that I asked Representative Atkins this morning if he would move your bill to my committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Lindu. I am also a pharmacist. I work for Thrifty White Pharmacies. We are a Minnesota-based company serving primarily rural communities across the upper Midwest. I am here representing the pharmacy community, specifically Minnesota Pharmacists Association, Minnesota Retail Association, and the National Association of Chain Drugstores. As Julie said, last year the legislature, we didn't like it, but last year the legislature voted to reduce pharmacy reimbursement and set a new lower reimbursement rate right at the end of the session last year. At the time that happened, The legislature, the Department of Human Services, did not realize that there was another larger shoe waiting to drop. The court decision had not been made, but September 26th, there was a change in AWP. As Julie said, you've all heard the term AWP, average wholesale price. It's very confusing. The important things to understand, the AWP went down, the cost of drugs to pharmacies did not. The impact of that change on September 26th was 3.5 times the rate reduction that the legislature voted for and passed at the end of the legislative session in terms of reduction in reimbursement to pharmacies. As Julie said, virtually all private plans, Medicare D plans, many of them are for-profit companies, voluntarily came to pharmacies, realizing that was not a sustainable reimbursement structure, and voluntarily revised their reimbursement structure to neutralize the effect of this change on AWP, except for Medicaid. We are able to keep fairly accurate data on our prescription business for third-party plans and Medicaid as well. Our data shows that the change on AWP since September 26th reduced our company's reimbursement for filling a Medicaid prescription by 20%. Currently, Minnesota Medicaid, among the 10 largest plans that we do business with in the company, Minnesota Medicaid pays $3.48 below the average of those 10 plans and $2.14 below the next lowest plan. Now, when you see the price of many prescriptions, you say, well, you know, $2, $3, how much difference does that really make? We have said before the average profit margin in our industry is about 2%. On an average prescription, that translates to about $1 a prescription profit. That means that for every Medicaid prescription that a pharmacy fills, they have to fill 2.5 additional prescriptions just to get back to break even for filling the one Medicaid prescription. That is not a sustainable reimbursement structure. Last year, I spoke to this committee and said there are 149 communities in the state of Minnesota that have only one pharmacy. Today, I can tell you that I know of personally, since last summer, 4 of those are closed. The communities of Ashby, Clara City, Lamberton, and Comfrey, since last summer, all lost their only pharmacy, leaving that community without pharmacy services, many people as much as 20 miles to drive for pharmacy service. When that happens in a community, I need to remind everyone that does not just impact the Medicaid population. It impacts the business community, and it impacts all of the citizens in that community and surrounding area. The September 26th change in AWP was not anticipated by the legislature. We are not here asking for a rate increase. We are simply here asking to reinstate the rate that we really didn't like, but was passed at the end of the legislative session last year. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Abler.
Thanks. This is, Representative Murphy and I have been working on this along with many others. And being a provider in the on a parallel niche, everything that I do in Medicaid, I do below cost. Everything a nursing home does in Medicaid, they do below cost. And the more we add to the Medicaid population, as per the proposal in Washington that they're talking about right now, adds 15 more million people to the Medicaid population. And I don't know how we see it as being sustainable. And the thing is that that this very same group has been talking about this will happen if you do too much of this, and then this event happened with the court case and seems to be the straw that's breaking the back, and I just think that's something that's just unacceptable, and I hope that, I mean, the governor's bill didn't address this, and he didn't address a lot of things, but I think that it, I hope in our, whatever bill that comes up, I hope that there's a way to do something about this. I just had a thought, and I have to ask a question. Is the amount that you get, this whatever price it is any of the drug reimbursements federal match, or is it all... It's all just a pot of money that comes and it's not matched. Like we cut 1%, we don't lose 2% or something like that, right?
There's no advantage to the state to changing the way AWP is used. It's really one, to my understanding, it's one fund. A portion of that is reimbursed federally, but whether you raise or lower AWP and the dispensing fee and so on does not impact
the department, I think. Yes.
Hi. We have a go ahead. State your name for the tape.
Sure. My name is Sarah Drake. I'm the pharmacy program manager at DHS. Mr. Chair, Representative Ibler. We received federal match on the reimbursement for prescriptions for Medicaid. Prescriptions at the usual federal financial purchase FFP rate. So for every dollar that we pay to pharmacies for the drug cost or for the dispensing fee, in most years we get another dollar. You know, we get 50 cents of that back from the federal government. Right now we're in an enhanced match period.
Right. Mr. Chair. And Ms. Drake, so if we do cut the rate to a pharmacy, then the impact in the pharmacy is more than what we save then. Is that right?
That would be correct, yes.
All right, so, and so we already get the match. So and we talked about this in a different committee, and I'm not, you're the messenger. I don't think you're the decision maker, and you're just one of the hardworking, good people there. But at some point, the department, somebody made a decision to dump this into the forecast and not hold it out as a thing that's going to have a lawsuit coming. In fact, I think I was just talking in the audience that they were going to do an injunction, but it all happened too fast. And the speedy finger on the forecast button went out the door before they could stop it. And I wish that wouldn't have happened. I'm going to stop there because there's no sense in impugning you at all. But if there wasn't a match, I was going to suggest that maybe we could work in some of this medication therapy management kind of work. And maybe if we could require that there's some of that that goes with it, we could get some money back to the back door. And if there's an idea there, I don't know if it's worth anything, but it's worth thinking about. But we spent a great deal of effort, and Rep. Murphy, on the general systems medical care thing for fear of hospitals losing a big chunk. And if we just call it a neutral mistake or thing that happened, but here we're going to lose pharmacies to serve the very population that population as well as greater ones. And in rural Minnesota, people have a hard time staying there anyway. And so if we keep closing everything there, then as a suburban person, I'm speaking on behalf of rural Minnesota, but we have to keep rural Minnesota open. We need to keep schools open and the pharmacies and Colburn's throughout Minnesota and wherever, just so they can be out there and have full service. Anyway, so that's just my commentary. I hope we can find, is it $3 million that this cost?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, it's $2.8 million, I believe, in fiscal year 2011.
Thank you.
And then it's a little more in subsequent years because the enhanced federal match goes away.
Thank you. Okay, any further questions? I don't see any, so Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 3266 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As amended, all those in favor?
No, we don't have to do that.
No,
that's right. Okay. And next is Representative Abler, 3611.
Good luck. Mr. Chair, I have some amazing. I have to get my order.
Call him before. one of the documents?
Yeah, I'm going to put it on the video. I can just let it be white. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. That's all I need. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Law 3611 be recommended to pass and then be held over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Representative Abler.
And I have an amendment to get it in the order that it should be.
Give me a copy of the bill.
Yeah. Anyway, I have the A-10-2371 amendment, which will actually make us not have to listen to one opponent to the bill. This was the some fragments of the governor's health bill, which I thought I'd see what I liked about it enough to stand up for it. And it and I decided I didn't really want to expand the flexible benefits to the whole world, and so this puts it back how it was. And I just offer one sentence to the existing flexible benefits plan. And I have an oral amendment to include to delete Section 4, which repeals the section I'm amending, so that wouldn't make any sense. So I'd like to incorporate that into my amendment. And then move the A-10-2371 amendment to get the bill in order so I can give my amazing presentation.
Let me see. Where is it? So could you go through that again?
Sure. This
I see the 2371 amendment, but I...
And this replaces what you Section
said about
1.
Deleting the section.
Right. Well, this replaces Section 1. In the bill with the old language plus one more sentence, which I'll describe when I do when I present the bill. And then Section 4 repeals the old flexible benefits plan, because what the governor wanted to do was to expand it to the whole market, and I'm not going there today. So.
Okay.
And so that just takes that back out where because it doesn't conform to what I'm doing.
Okay, so Representative Abler... moves the A-10-2371 amendment. Why don't we do that first, then we'll do Section 4.
Sure.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I guess I'm looking at your amendment here. That's what we're on, I guess. And I'm just not understanding. I'm sorry if I missed it, but what are you trying to do here? I just don't understand this sentence that you're adding.
Okay, well,
Representative Abler.
It's actually in the bill, too. And so I added that sentence to the new language expanding the program, and so I can describe that now if you like. It's however you want to do it. The amendment actually shrinks the impact of that sentence to back to a current law application. But the issue is I'll just get to my testimony on that part of the bill. The issue has to do with in the flexible benefits thing, which was adopted a couple of years ago. It was my clear understanding that they were not going to eliminate classes of providers, but they were going to eliminate services. And so if a 20-year-old man didn't need pregnancy services, then they wouldn't have to. They could provide us a program that would not cover that. If they didn't want mental health, if they didn't want various things, I don't know what mental health is now with the new law change, but back then there were things that people wanted to buy an a la carte plan that was kind of shrunk down. $500 for this and so on, and to keep the cost low, then a plan could offer a limited benefit set, a limited benefits plan. In fact, Blue Cross has the Freedom 123 plan, which is one version of that. And so this restores it to what I understood it to be at the time, which is why it passed so handily. But it is new language, and so what this says is that they can't exclude a category provider, but they can exclude any benefits. And this would not expand any benefits that were there, but if you could do that, it's kind of service, and you're allowed to do it. That's the amendment that is there. And in the bill that I introduced, you can see on the, it's in the, on lines 122 and 123 in the original bill, that same sentence is there, but and the amendment that I'm bringing leaves that sentence alone, but just adds it to the current limited benefit set, which is only available to small employers, not to the whole general market. Does that help?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Abler. Now at least I understand what you're doing. I'm not sure I agree with what you're doing, though. Because, well, let me just first say, I was never in favor of this anyway. You know, but, you know, it's the kind of a thing that's you know, it, I don't know if it's working, but it's there. It's happening. But I frankly don't see, if we're going to let insurers offer plans that leave out categories of benefits, I really don't see why we wouldn't let them leave out categories of providers. If they don't want to provide, you know, occupational therapy, or they don't want to provide speech, or, your, you know, speech therapy. Well, I guess I'm giving the wrong example because I'm giving a service, not a provider.
See, but how
if they,
goes.
If they want to say, we don't want to cover licensed social workers, you've got to get your therapy from a psychologist or something. I don't see why we would not let them do that. Can you explain why we shouldn't let them do that?
Representative Abler.
Well, sure. Actually, in your example, you've just allowed the higher-priced professional and not the lower-priced one. And there's more of those around. But that's what sort of happens. And so, but the dialogue around the time, and my understanding was, and the reason I voted for it, was we were told in the dialogue that this was not going to limit categories of providers, but it was going to limit services. And very often what they wind up limiting is some of the lower cost providers, and they keep the higher cost places of services. Like, for instance, they always have hospitalization, which is the highest priced place to do anything. But they may neglect to include some providers who could do a service out of a hospital. And so that's the point of it. And so to me, it's rather going back to what we all thought the law was going to be. But by emphasizing it, it appears to be a change, and I'm willing to accept that it may be a change from what Blue Cross interpreted it to be. When Commerce, when I talked to Commerce about this particular plan, which does not allow all providers to function, specifically chiropractors, that's the old fight that's been fought since 19-something. They were surprised that they left out that, because they did not recall that was the agreement either. Although Commerce did approve the plan, but I don't know if they thought of that when they approved it. But when I talked to Mr. Gross about that last summer, or maybe it was autumn, he was surprised that they had eliminated an entire category. So that's the point of that piece. And if we're trying to contain costs, then sometimes we have to save people from themselves and allow the cheapest categories of providers to be covered as well as the most expensive. So, as regards the amendment, it's in both the bill and the, this just shrinks it down, the application of it. So I hope that helps you.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I guess I, you know, one, your first point seems to be that you thought it was there and you want to put it in because you thought it was there. And I never thought that was somehow excluded. And it seems to me that if we're talking about letting the market decide this and letting people not buy more than they want and so on, and, you know, they have to have it disclosed to them, I presume, what's in a plan that they're buying. I frankly don't see why we would limit it in this way. And, you know, your argument notwithstanding, well, they, you know, the plan might cover the more expensive and not the less expensive and so on, but that's up to them. I mean, the question is, should we then, if we're going to let them be flexible, why should we then not let them be flexible? I mean, I could just as easily say, gee, you should cover mammograms, you know, or some other category of preventive service, and they might say to me, well, it's a flexible plan, and, you know, we don't want to cover, we don't want to provide that. We're going to tell people, the willing buyer is going to know that's not covered, and, you know, willing buyer, willing seller, and there you go. So it seems to me that it's consistent with the whole theory of the flexible benefit plan to leave it as it is and not tell them they've got a, that they can't exclude certain providers.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, the whole topic of insurance equality has decades of time behind it. I think it's back in the 80s that this matter was fought in a very passionate time, and the plans then agreed to include that as a covered, as a mandate, ironically. Curious that it is the low-cost provider and actually helps some people. But it's not like it's, for some reason, and not to sound paranoid or anything, but it's the same reason, if I can just touch on a sensitive point, why I just was offered the chance to sign the Equal Rights Amendment. So why would we have that? Somebody thinks that group needs to have a special acknowledgement.
And in the past, there's been terrible unfairnesses in the name of gender. And we have racial laws that, and for some reason, people think a group needs to be emphasized so that they're properly used. And it almost comes to that sometimes. It's almost like a religion sometimes. Having done this 31 years, I'm astonished. And so I know it's sensitive, but I'm just helping you understand, why would you have a law to require that? The data that's out indicates that if you use chiropractic in an appropriate way, the whole system saves money. But yet some of the treatment of that profession, which happens to be mine also, would think it was the most expensive. And if it's about patient care and quality, and this was a fight that was fought in the 80s about this one. And so I don't know if it helps, but that's just why I would, even though if you look at the turf battles about nurses and registered nurses and LPNs and physical therapists and athletic trainers and all this, the fight goes on as you interface on turf. And I wish it wasn't even a necessary thing to bring up. And someday it won't be. But it's unfortunate that that it continues like that. And people should have access to the right kind of care, the most cost-effective person. But this has nothing to do with what kind of services are available, you know, what topic and what codes even, but more as to who's allowed to provide it. We just had a bill that I fought on for 3 years trying to get licensed professional clinical counselors the freedom to be paid in Medicaid, who happened to be the low-cost provider. And the fiscal note showed that we had to cost money, and actually they saved money. And so, but for those kinds of fights, the people don't get a chance to have these providers who are suitable. So, I mean, it's, you know, so I don't know if I persuaded you, but that's just the issue of it. So.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, could I ask that we're discussing the bill, really, not the amendment, because this is also in the bill, and I have comments on this issue as well and questions. But could we please proceed to put the bill in the form the author wanted it, so we address the issue of putting it back to the small employers and also deleting the Section 4, and then have the discussion on the bill as the author intended it before we continue?
Okay. Since that sentence is in the bill, why don't we adopt the A-10-2371 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
So the amendment passes, and then Representative Abler moves to
delete
313 and 314.
Right.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So we've got the bill the way the author wants it.
And Mr. Chair.
What? Oh. And I would move that we delete line 315 as well.
Yeah, that's correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So that amendment is passed.
And Mr. Chair, and we can discuss that as long as you like. The main reason the bill is here has to do with Section 2, but as the committee desires, do you want to talk about Section 1 for a while and then move on to Section 2 or however the committee likes?
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that issue of Section 1, then the Representative Leaving started the discussion on this part. Abler, you and I both last week and this week have had some discussion of this piece as well as the interesting piece. I'm looking forward into your other sections as well. My question here is, I understood your intent in terms of allowing them to exclude certain benefits but not particular providers. But when I read this language and I think about things they do under plans like this and all the other types of plans, is they have specified networks as well. And when I read this language, I see it as going, and this just occurred to me in the last, even since I talked to you last today, but I see it going much further than saying, you know, you have to cover or not cover, you know, back therapy or, you know, and therefore anybody who can do that is allowed to do that if you cover it, which would, and then take out chiropractic language. But this language I view as is forcing them to include every clinic, every, you know, whether it's any type of provider group, okay, any type of provider practicing anywhere, and that they couldn't do networks as they currently do. So they couldn't say we have definite types of policies, and some of them give you a much more delineated network, and others give you the premium network, and you can pretty much go wherever you want, or we have tiers that if you pay this one, you can go to the premium network, and if you want to pay a lower cost, you can only go to these providers. So I understood your intent, and while I still have some questions about that and what the original, I don't believe that this language is limited at all to your intent, and that's my concern with this language.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bond, actually, it's very limiting. It does not, it just says type of provider. There is any willing provider language, which has been introduced also as part of those same decades, which we have not been successful in getting in on behalf of the whole provider coalition. In the auto world, any willing provider is correct. Many work comp networks limit providers. This does not, but to this specific point, it does not require that you have more than one. It's just you can't rule out a category. And then in that category, like, for instance, Blue Cross. I'm a Tier 1 provider or whatever their group is. And so I'm in all their preferred network stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, but people that have a higher utilizations or other reasons that they don't need one in that area, they have a limited network. But this does not do anything to limit how small a network can be, whatever they deem to be access. And so it's just to eliminate a provider based on the category they are, like LPCCs or, physical therapists or any particular group that they would eliminate based upon that category, mm-hmm. is just not where we are these days. The thought has been talking about in many of the health reform things about having providers work at the top of their license, having access and inclusion, and flexibility on the part of the plans not to limit one group over another, maybe limiting services, $500 for the back care, so much for obstetric care, and so on.
Representative Bunn.
Mr. Chair, I have one more question for Mr. Ilver, but I also wondered if we could have brief testimony by on this from the plans or whoever wants to testify on this piece before we do the big piece about the rest of the bill. But my brief question is, when I read, while it doesn't say a particular category of provider like the chiropractor reference on this particular plan, when they do not cover all behavior and mental health and chemically dependency services, it seems to me implicitly that eliminates a long list of specific provider types. Various mental health professionals, chemically licensed chemical dependency counselors, et cetera. And so while it's not spelled out in that way, I find implicit to that is long lists of specific providers that are excluded from coverage of this plan. So I'm struggling with how this is different in that regard. Well, I also appreciate testimony on
it. Mr. Chair, and actually I'd like to present my bill. This is actually the minor part of it, and I'll comment. If I could actually present the heart of the bill and why it's in a finance committee, and then we can take the time that's left to discuss whatever parts you want. But in terms of the to your very question, it does not eliminate a particular category, but if a person is licensed to provide the service that this plan provides, then the plan would be free to contract with whom it chose of any category, as opposed to eliminating somebody by category. So in mental health, maybe LPCCs, maybe licensed social workers, maybe a psychologist, maybe a licensed family, marriage, and family therapist, those all could qualify if they would be in the network and if they wanted to participate. It's just unusual to eliminate one category again. So that's the matter of that. But okay, I was trying to make a joke in the beginning.
Why don't you go on to section 2.
Thank you very much.
When you get through that, we will allow people from the audience to comment.
Because there's people who want to talk about section 2 even more than section 1. So I was going to suggest to you that if you watched Avatar, some of the special effects there were pretty amazing. And I want to point out that the effects here are going to be really quite the effects here. and so, Mr. Chair, what the bill suggests is that, my real presentation, which I hope to find $100 million for this committee to spend and maybe rebuy back some of the pharmacy benefits, is by telling you that the money to be found in the healthcare system is in the high-utilizing providers. Pick any kind of provider you like. If this amazing graphic here that Walt Disney let me use for the day, represents the bell curve of any particular provider group, be it a cardiologist or a chiropractic or a rural hospitalist or urban hospitalist, by provider, not by clinic. That you have the low cost per person over a course of a year providers and the high cost per person. But this would be your average, you know, standard group. And then you have, note the two colors. Does that come up in there? Anyway, that was meant to be more dramatic, Mr. Chair. Now, this is the 84th percentile. And if at 84th percentile, that's one standard deviation above the mean, you have 16% of the people above that number, obviously, with that group. So that's the end of that picture. This is what they wind up spending, though. If you take your average clinician on the continuum of what they spend, you take your 84th percentile provider here, that the top 16% spend about 35% of the money. And we heard about that same kind of number in the people who distribute prescriptions. The top 25% give like 80% or something of the prescriptions. And the focus, as a person who's been managed by the system now for 31 years, I've come to this realization because I've lived it. And so if there's a way to go after the real money, then that would be smart. If you're going to manage the lower 10% of providers, you could take all their money and not save anything. But if you decided that 84% of the average of the 84th percentile is enough money to spend on a provider on a service, all this money above the line is available for recapture. And so, in short, what the bill would do. And this is a placeholder. I just kept it simple. There's a little more complicated way if you actually like it, if the department agrees there's money, and if we decide to go forward with it. But this is the essence of health reform and what we've failed to accomplish. For one thing, 84% of the providers agree that 84% is enough. 84% of doctors, chiropractors, whoever, do not agree on anything. If you ask them how they would have managed a particular case and what they should have done. These are the providers. The more homogenous, the better for the group. But if you have enough data over enough time, you will get this curve appearing in this provider in their profile. And according to Joe Lally from Delta, 6 years ago, he told me that it's in their head how they practice. And the same providers are generally high in auto, they're high in work comp, they're high in Medicaid, they're high in commercial plans, and it's just their habit. They just do more tests, they do more knee replacements, they do more adjustments, they do more bypasses. And just because they spent more money does not mean that the care is any better quality. In fact, the excess care may actually cause harm. And the plans have, in individual conversations over the last couple of years, have confirmed this to me. And it's right in the range of 16% gets 35% of the money. And so the model is, if I would notice this group here, and if I would withhold, firstly decide you want to do it, but if you withhold 30% of the payment from this group that they would have got for any service, and at the end of the year, you would then rebate them an amount to get them back to the 84th percentile, that leaves all this money, which is at least 10%. And the department may give us a better note, but that's my idea. 10% on a billion is 100 million. And so it's real money, and it's money that's not well spent, based upon the opinion of 84% of their provider group, and you'll discover when the data comes back from Maine on all that we're collecting, that there is no quality element to that. It's only utilization. And there's an example of this kind of thing being done. It's called ME. Blue Cross, I had a meeting with them this morning, and we talked about this. They set up a raw number target for me to hit. In this case, $270 a year of service per person, which is a number we argue about if that's a good number, but they have no problem setting up a number. My utilization last year was 272, so I didn't quite hit the target. But 272 is not very much to spend on a person in a year. Just if you're in the business, you know it doesn't go very far. But that's their number. And they withheld from me $6,700 over the course of the year, at which I'll get some percentage back. I don't even know what the percentage is because they just send us some back like, oh, here comes the money back. But they have no trouble withholding money from me in this very same model. And if I would exceed the target, if I would get 260 or 250 per year, then they would give me a bonus. I don't suggest a bonus because we're trying to save money. But they do take the money away if I exceed that number. And so something else, Representative Liebling and others, the reason I'm so interested in all this provider stuff is because they use as experimental professionals to try this stuff out on, and then they export it into the other system, and it's only half of a joke. Many things that are done to manage providers have been tried on us first, and that's a whole different story. But out of that, I get this idea. And so let me explain to you the other ideas that have been tried in health reform. We spent some time, and I voted for packages of care, or bundle, whatever we call them, these care packages. And so if you have a care packet, what do we call them?
Bundles.
Bundles of care, yeah. So if you have a bundle of care for an ankle fracture, and this average clinician, who, by the way, does great work, he's the one you find impressive, or she, and all the, between 30 and 70 percentile is where the most normal, if back to the original chart, that's where there's a lot of clinicians doing their work. And all this best practice, standards of care, quality measures, they do it normally. They do it anyway. And so the low ones underutilize, the high ones overutilize generally. And so let's say we do a package of care on this for an ankle fracture. And so this doctor gets the same money he would have got because we set it up. That's the right average price. And so we think, well, we finally captured this overutilizer up here, and so now he's not going to get paid what he used to get paid. And so let's, oh, they have an infection now. And so the good doctor gives them some salve. They got a sample from Pfizer, and so they tell him to put some salve on his ankle. But the person over here who's got it, who figures out that they're just heavier billing, they're going to do a bundle of care for the infection. And so, and the thing is that these people have good staff. They have a lot of staff. They have the best records. They're really nice, and they have clinics that look great. This guy here has enough staff to keep open, and their records aren't quite as good. They don't have all the new computers, and they do stuff by hand a lot, but the quality of care is really very good. And so this person is kind of sad about their ankle, and they don't like the infection. They're kind of depressed, and the doctor here says, it's going to be all right. You know, in a month or so, you'll be back on your feet. Why don't you do some hand chair aerobics, and you'll kind of get to do that a little bit. And here's a, you know. But this person here does a depression bundle of care. And so, and it's all documented. And because their habit is to, just, they're not for any, I'm not even giving motives issue, but they just, by habit, are inclined to do all they can do. And I'm going to keep it on a positive thing. There are some terms I would use. But so the thing is, with all this reform, you don't really save any money. Because their billing practices, according to Joel Alley, are in their head. And this person here, if you give them all the money in the world, or this person down here, my practice pattern is about here. But if you give this person all the money in the world, they might go from 10 to 11%. But they just don't have it in their head to do more things because they believe that to be adequate. So instead of building the system on these really quality providers from the 30 to 70 percentile, we put pressure across the board when we manage to squish them all. And however you think, however they think they are, however they really are being managed, these providers in the lower 50 percentile feel the pressure of management. When the reform happens, they say, I'm fearful Medicare will be cut 50% and I'll go out of business. They told me that. Like, oh no, what am I going to do? And in reality, if we leave these people alone and just let them do whatever they want to do, they're going to do normal things. And so if we put our management effort instead of down here, but more into this top chunk, and especially into the higher of the top chunk, looking over time, looking over their habit over time, this is where the management will actually turn some money. One more picture, and then I'll just discuss it, and then we'll... I know a witness, at least one witness wants to come up and offer their concerns. This is the chart you've seen about the high-cost patients and the cheap patients. These are the young invincibles. These are the high-cost ones. But I want to remind you that these very high-cost patients, as well as the young invincibles, wind up in the hands of the whole bell curve of clinicians. And if indeed the top 16% spend 35% of the money, then some of this money up here is having fallen in the hands of that kind of service and is absolutely wasted. A good share of it.
And so now we talk about healthcare homes and other reforms. And so if you, once you dispose of this, now care coordination, more alternative care, more, you know, improvements in medicine, bring the care down to here, to what it should be. And I will assert that if you reduce the baseline of the health cost in this country or the state by 10%, which is what I'm proposing, you'd be really happy. And Mr. Hickey would come down and say, you've done a very good thing, and now I can keep my small businesses in business. And the chamber would actually agree with me for once on some things. And they'd be happy too. And in our state plans, in the state plans, we would save considerable money, enough to begin to lower the trajectory to be a more normal curve. And so the proposal in the bill says that we should withhold from these people above 84 percentile 30% of their money, and at the end of the year, or the pay period, whatever it's going to be, we would then return, in the same way that Blue Cross does to me, a big pot of money to them. And that's simply what the bill says. And how you would implement this in real life would be to also ask them questions more often, like, why is that necessary to do that particular? Why do you have the high level? Why do you have a 99203 exam instead of a 99202 exam, which is a higher level? Can you document that? And so that's the point of it. And that's pretty much that part of the bill. And I'll stand for questions. And I know at least one witness wants to come talk about
okay,
that.
Okay. Why don't we hear from the witnesses? And I know Dave Renner wants to talk. And
I'm not sure he's enthusiastic, but maybe he'll say that himself.
There he is.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner representing the Minnesota Medical Association. I apologize, I don't have any nice charts or pictures to
These
bring with.
These are pretty nice charts.
Those are very nice.
Well, here, I got a blank page.
Let me start by saying there's much of what Representative Abler was saying about what we need to do to reform our systems, we don't disagree. We think that we have a payment system that does not reward efficiency, and we have been trying to work with you and others to do that. And I think we're moving down those roads through things like medical homes and our healthcare homes, the care coordinations, and baskets of care. I would caution you, however, to do this with our public programs, because you have heard me say this before, and you will probably hear me say this again, that the rates that we are paying our public programs are absurdly low. We are paying right now on average payments that are 37% of what the private market pays, and that's based on Minnesota community measurement numbers. So I would argue that this is not the population. If there are providers that you can argue that are overutilizing maybe for the wrong reasons, I would say this is not the population they're doing it, because they are losing money on these people. They are not making money on these programs. So that's one concern. The other concern, because as I understand the bill, this is not a bonus if you are an efficient provider. This is a further cut in your payments. So that makes us very nervous. I would also caution you in that there was an article, which I've just shared with a few of you, just, matter of fact, officially printed today, but came out yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine, that talks about the limitations that we have with the whole area of profiling and using profiling data for payments. This is a study that was just came out looking for the years of 2004-2005 of Massachusetts data, looking at the private sector there. And the conclusion was that when they have looked at using tiering programs with two tiers, based on the data of Massachusetts, 22% of physicians were put in the wrong tier. Matter of fact, one of the studies they were looking at, when looking at physicians who were classified as low cost, 43% actually were not low cost of those physicians. So if we are going to start using tiering programs for payments, I would caution you that we are not sophisticated and ready to do that yet. Matter of fact, the final conclusion that they make in this study was, and I'll quote, these findings bring into question both the utility of cost profiling tools for high-stake uses, such as tiered health plan products, and the likelihood that they will reduce healthcare spending. Consumers, physicians, purchasers, all are at risk of being misled by the results produced by these tools. So if we are looking to try to put in tiering programs, especially among our low-income populations, our public, our healthcare safety net programs, first of all, they've not been tested. We don't know if they work. Second of all, the payments are absurdly low. That that raises concerns. And then even according to the, this was a RAND study that came out, saying that we are not sophisticated yet enough into being able to identify who are the high cost, who are the low cost. I would encourage us to continue down the road of reforms we are doing and trying to continue to work on our peer grouping data that we are gathering in Minnesota and not pursue this at this point. I'd be happy to answer questions.
I would just comment. I would see one of the authors is Elizabeth McGlynn, who is a really famous healthcare person.
Right. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've not had a chance to study this since it just came out today, but this is, again, RAND Corporation. This is a group of fairly highly respected health researchers, and they were trying to look at a state that has been doing this as long as anyone in Massachusetts and say we're just quite not there yet.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Renner, I understand your concerns about the issue of the tiering and the research on that, but putting that aside for a moment, I do like the elegance of this proposal, the simple elegance of this proposal. And my question for you is if we reconstructed this to save a little bit less money than the $100 million, or perhaps, you know, something less than that, and actually raise the rates for our Medicare payments for the rest overall while saving money via this top-end reduction, how might you respond to that as an alternative?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, I think from the Medical Association's point of view, we don't disagree that we need to find ways to reward quality, whether they be higher quality, lower cost providers, more efficient providers. We're not opposed to the concept. We just think we don't have the data capacities or the sophistication yet to know how to do that equitably. And so the concern would be, especially with the public programs, where most tiering products we do in the private market, and they're going on today, they are related to giving incentives to consumers or disincentives to consumers through cost sharing. It's a hard thing to do with folks who are in these programs because they don't have the income for those cost sharings. So most of them are then tied to payment rates. And do bonuses, would that make it more acceptable? I guess it's better than further cuts, but I think we would still raise some concerns about whether we are ready to go this route yet.
Representative Bunn.
Just to be clear, I wasn't talking about a bonus system. I was talking about do a slight raising across the board of our MA payment rates, since we all have issues with or underpaying in this area, but and still Representative Abler's mm-hmm. proposal, but so that net we still have a huge savings, mm-hmm. so we could adjust that. So, because I have sympathy for the issue that our rates are too low overall.
Right. Mr. Chair, I think I would, again, I just don't know how we identify who those folks are yet. I think instead, the one chart I was glad Representative Abler had in his drawings, the chart that we continue to push is we're serious about controlling costs and bending that cost curve. Where we need to focus is on are those with chronic disease, because that's where 70% of the healthcare spending is.
Any other questions for Mr. Renner? Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this is a question either for Mr. Renner or Representative Abler. In the proposal before us, it proposes that we start looking at this tiering system with primary care providers. And I'm just wondering what your reaction to that is, or why. Maybe for Representative Abler, why primary care? And it seems like if we want to look at the, you know, just very callously, if we want to look at the money, it seems like we'd want to look at specialists.
Oh, actually, I'd like to amend the word primary care. Actually, that was the genesis of this bill is I took the governor's bill and he had some language and I fixed it, and that's actually an artifact. So it was my intention to look at every provider, at least as my proposal. And so let's just move that out, shall we? I'd like to move. Is that okay, Representative Huntley? If I'd like to just delete on line 219 primary care and just make it provider tiering. And then also wherever else it's
219 and 235.
Yeah, that would be the whole. We delete.
Take out the primary care and leave the word provider in.
I think we just take out the second sentence on line 234, take out Dutch hearing, and then the whole line 235, just to keep it clear. And I appreciate the attention to detail. And I want to point out that a lot of my ideas are three-quarters thought through, but I think that you've gotten the essence of what I'm trying to bring forward. That's a good improvement to it. So, delete everything after the period on line 234, and then delete 235.
Right. Yep. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. So that takes care of Representative Murphy's question. Mr. Hickey.
Thank you, Mr.
You guys both here? This is great.
And
get us both, Jim.
We only have 10 minutes. So, and Mr. Hickey will probably take up 9.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to yield to Ms. Nelson here at first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Nelson from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, the 7 nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. I'm testifying in opposition to Section 1 of House File 3611, not on Section 2. We're not commenting on that. As Representative Abler indicated, all health plans have the option of offering this lower cost option in a very price-sensitive market under the current law. Our understanding of this bill and now the amendment is that it will limit our ability to offer limited networks and benefits to small employers. For example, as you've heard, the great Freedom 123 product, we offer that product. We began offering Freedom 123 after we filed with the Department of Commerce, and it was approved last July. It offers a limited network and some limited benefits, some of those benefits you've discussed here today. We currently have about 60 small groups that have chosen this option of a plan, and it is a choice. We would like to continue to offer a lower cost option to all our small employers, and therefore are opposed to this section.
And Ms. Nelson, could you give me some of the ideas, the things that are left out of these policies that you would find in a more comprehensive? I mean, I know in an individual market you have a plan that does not cover pregnancy, but I don't think you could do that for groups that are, can't remember the size, 15 or larger, they have to have pregnancy coverage.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Yeah. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, some of the things that we do not include are bariatric surgery, as you heard, services from a doctor of chiropractic, hair prosthesis.
Go through the chiropractic one again.
Services from a doctor of chiropractic, among other things, if you want me to list them all. Infertility, assisted reproduction. And we have a full disclosure that we do give to the plans, and each member has to sign this before they go into the plan so they know exactly what they're being offered.
Mr. Chairman, for that final 1 minute. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. And we're probably the group most affected by this bill, and we're one of the groups that pushed hard for this law back in 05. And thank those of you who supported it back in 05. I did want to testify against Section 1 of House File 3611. The bill as amended and urge you to support the amendment to delete this language. The plans need to have the flexibility to implement these in a way that are going to be helpful to small business and try to achieve some significant savings. If significant savings are not achieved, the consumers or the small business owners in this case will not opt for them. And this is certainly going to make things harder for the plans to provide a more flexible and a cheaper plan, which is the whole point of the law. And so we're opposed to this. I don't think it's going to help. Really excited about what Blue Cross is doing. They've really stepped up and offered the plan, I think, sort of the way the legislature envisioned. Hope there's going to be more choices in the future, hopefully one that includes chiropractic, and maybe that's coming soon. But this language is not helpful, and we urge you to support the amendment to delete it.
Any other comments?
Anybody else want to testify? Then I have a few more.
Anybody else want to testify? Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, let me offer some comments, and then the committee can take the last few minutes and do whatever. And I appreciate Representative Bond's comments about the simple elegance of this. This is scalable. I think if I was really going to do it, I would start at the 70th percentile and withhold 30% of that to make sure we get the people who are at risk. But I want to point out that no doctor will lose a penny if they're charging under 84th percentile per person per year. And all the issues about risk adjustment and the kinds of groups that people are serving, there is no data that lets us do that. And I wasn't impugning Blue Cross necessarily for this, what they've done, but I want to point out that in the market, this very thing has been done by the witnesses just here. And we are facing, and this is especially important, I think, as we face the $1 billion problem coming up now and the $5 billion or whatever and change coming up in the next cycle. If we don't do something like this, in the bill that will come back from conference will be another provider rate cut, removal of people from coverage, and limitation of services, again, a second bite at the apple of dental, more discussion about how little therapy and chiropractic and all that to offer, how little to all people in the hospital, caps, and all kinds of things that are going to cause great harm. And so what this does, it encourages the 30 to 70 percentile clinicians, which are the ones that make the backbone of the state, that do the work that we're proud of, the ones who are already doing the work that you like, and it takes the pressure off of them to let them actually thrive in their small businesses and actually spend more time with their patients instead of more oversight and the pressure that comes across the board, and puts the pressure where it needs to be in the system on those who have a less inclination to be more cost-effective and maybe even quality-oriented in their practices. So with that, I'll just stand for questions.
Well, just a comment. My wife sometimes gets physical therapy, and the bill is usually like $500 for a half an hour. And when she goes to the chiropractor, I don't think the physical therapist is getting all that money. When she goes to the chiropractor, it's about the cost of a good meal. And the chiropractor does a great job with her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Bunn. Now we're gonna have to move along, though.
Yeah. First of all, I want to ask, thank you again, Representative Ayler, for bringing this elegant and potentially very useful idea to the table, and I hope we move forward and get some fiscal notes on that. I'm still troubled by the portion Section 1. I, too, like Representative Liebman said, am not particularly in favor that we move into that I would want to, as a first solution, choose plans for our citizens in Minnesota that have lesser benefits. I view it as something I have supported the last many years and continue to do because we have a broken healthcare system that is very high cost for our individuals and our small employers. And so we're looking until we find a more comprehensive solution, a more effective solution to our overall healthcare system woes, that we find lower cost solutions for people to access in the meantime. But I, like Representative Liebling, feel that although I don't, maybe wasn't present for the original discussion, really feel that this time, and certainly without any further discussion in the policy committee, which is where I think this piece should have been discussed, would not like to move forward with this portion of it while we addressed your exciting idea in the tiering. So I would like to make a oral amendment to just delete Section 1 from this bill. And, of course, the Section 1 we're talking about is the Section 1 that's in his amendment language here.
So Representative Bunn moves that Section 1 of the amended bill be deleted.
Mr. Chair.
Which would convert to current law about that section, yeah.
Representative Ayler.
We discussed it pretty thoroughly. It would be nice if it could stay in. The committee gets to decide, but please vote no.
Any other comments on that? Okay. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
No. All those opposed say no. No.
No.
Hey. Here comes. Well, I can say we can do a division and make it easy for you if you want. But
I'll wait till you call.
I'm deaf on this side. So. So all those who voted in favor, please raise your hand. And opposed, you lose.
Well, the bill is kind of big anyway, Mr. Chair. It'll move better if it's smaller, probably.
Yep. So Representative Ayler then moves that House File 3611 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. We might have to be here in the evenings next week, but so have a good weekend. And the meeting is adjourned.